the compassionate, the merciful. 30 years ago, Imam Khomeini, who's pictured behind me, led a nation of believers to form a revolution centered around the ideals of Islam and justice. And now, 30 years later, that revolution has impacted the life of every Iranian, every Muslim, and perhaps every individual on this globe. Our intention in the next 2 hours is to try and capture and engage the realities of this revolution and the realities of the impact of this revolution globally. As your MC tonight, I invite everyone to please attentively listen to our two honored speakers, and following it, we will have a question and answer session. I ask that you save all your comments and questions for the question and answer session. Thank you. Our first speaker tonight is Dr. Hamid Algar. Dr. Algar is perhaps the only intellectual to have predicted the Islamic Revolution almost a decade before it occurred. He has met Imam Khomeini personally on several occasions, and he has written very extensively on the subject. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hamid Algar.
I'm very happy to be here on this occasion when we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. The brother just mentioned that I predicted the triumphant emergence of the revolution. This is a slight exaggeration, but I'm happy to accept it. And profiting from it, let me make a further prediction that the Islamic Republic, despite all enmity that is shown towards it by administrations, past and present and near future, will indeed survive and thrive and form a nucleus of opposition to global arrogance. I'm also happy to be here this evening on the same platform as Imam Musa. Imam Musa and me, I think we met precisely 30 years ago, maybe a little more, a little less, but before the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And I think the most recent time that we met was when we were both traveling and to Iran. Our plane was not to land in Tehran, but because of poor weather conditions, the plane was diverted to Shiraz. So the two of us had some hours to kill in Shiraz, and so the two of us were walking around Shiraz, to all appearances an outwardly ill-assorted couple of people, but inwardly we have, alhamdulillah, a great deal in common. So I'm very happy to be with Imam Musa again on this occasion. About the revolution itself and the 30 years that have followed, there is of course a great deal to be said. And I hope no one expects from me, despite my academic position, a systematic review of all that has happened in the past 30 years. It occurs to me that the following half-line poetry from Hafiz has some suitability to what happened in Iran and what is still underway. In the second half of the first line of the first poem in Iran, Hafiz says, "Ke'esh asan nebun aval, vani uftar mushkil ha." Love appeared easy at first, and then difficulties occur. The difficulties are those which have been confronted, and in most cases, alhamdulillah, surmounted in the past 30 years. But let me, by way of a beginning, stress this element of esh. What does esh, love, have to do with revolution? I would say that in the last analysis, of course, I'm not a political scientist, God forbid, in the first analysis and the last analysis, the Islamic Revolution of Iran was indeed an affair of esh. It was an affair of love, in the first place, for Islam, of devotion to Islam, devotion to the traditions in particular of Shia Islam, devotion to the ideas of the Quran, and devotion to the matchless person of Imam Khomeini. And I would like to begin, or maybe this is a third beginning, by invoking the memory of a noble and matchless personage. I had the great privilege and honor of meeting him on several occasions. My own reminiscences are not, in the larger scheme of things, very important. However, they are for me a precious and of lasting significance. I was first introduced, not to the person of the Imam, but to the writings and the ideas of the Imam, by Shahid Mustafa Chamraev, whose name will be familiar to many of you in this audience. He was here at Berkeley for many years, and it was he who played a significant role in raising Islamic awareness among Iranian students here at that time. And it was he who provided me with copies of some of the writings of Imam Khomeini before he had become well-known outside of the country or outside the circle of the Iranian Muslim activists. Shahid Chamraev, as many of you may know, was also a person of great devotion and purity. He had, of course, an intermediate stage. He went to Lebanon. I was all important there, significant in organizing the Islamic resistance. After the triumph of the revolution, he went to Iran and became Minister of Defense and was martyred in the course of that which in Iran is correctly called the imposed war. That is to say, the war unleashed on Iran by Iraq at the instigation of a variety of foreign powers, of course, in fact, through the United States. In any event, this was my first long distance, as it were, introduction to the Imam. I then met him in person for the first time when he was still in the last stage of his prolonged exile at Montfichet in France. And in fact, this photograph behind me, I'm pretty sure, was taken in Montfichet. He stayed in a modest house in this rural suburb of Paris, and three times a day, he would emerge from that house, come across the road, and leave those of us who were visiting him in prayer in a small garden. I spoke with him only briefly, but the important thing, at least for me, about the Imam was that here was a man who spoke with his being, with his presence, not only with his words. Even before he spoke, and his words were precious, his whole person, his whole bearing spoke. The Imam was a man of dignity and humility at one and the same time. He was for me a living mistaf, a living, what shall I say in English, indicator, emblem of one who humbles himself before God and as a result thereby attains an unparalleled degree of dignity and respect among men. The Imam was a person of supreme tranquility. Tranquil at the most critical times. For example, it is said that when he was arrested and sent into exile in 1964, the Shah's agents came to his house in Rome in the dead of the night, bumped him in a car and took him off to the airport, the first stage of his exile in Turkey. And he himself was utterly calm. But the driver, the wretched man who had the job of transporting the Imam into exile, was trembling and miserable. And the Imam calmed him down. He said, "It's okay, don't worry. All will be well." At later stages, when he was returning to Iran, precisely from his exile, in February of 1979, he sat there calmly on the plane drew a blanket over his head and went to sleep. At the same time, those that were accompanying him, or at least some of those who were accompanying him, according to what they told me, were terrified that once the plane landed in Tehran, after all the Shah's forces were still on the rampage, well, the plane would be shot down, there would be denied landing, this, that, or the other. But the Imam was calm. And throughout the prolonged, what is called, hostage crisis, again, the Imam, on every conceivable occasion, exhibited total serenity and calmness. Contrast this with the behavior of Carter at that time. Oh, he was sort of jittering nervously and twitching all the time whenever the subject of Iran came up. This is what I mean, a tranquility, a profound tranquility. That comes from realizing that all matters are ultimately in the hand of God, and the duty of the Muslim, individually and collectively, is to submit himself to the will of Allah and attempt to implement it in whatever way be appropriate. After the revolution, I had again the privilege of meeting the Imam, initially in December of 1979. At that point he was back in form and living in an extremely simple house. An extremely simple and small house. Oh, this simplicity in the living conditions of the Imam was truly remarkable. He spurned any form of comfort in his personal living arrangements. The only thing that adorned the room where he sat was a folded blanket on the ground, on which he sat, not even a cushion on which to lean. But more important than in this small detail, what has rooted itself more firmly in my memory, at one point in his company, and Hojjatul Islam Al-Asuli, we went onto the roof of this small house, which overlooked a small Uche Yachjar, as you call it. And it was blocked off at either end most of the time. But every now and then, the Imam would go onto the roof of the house, and the gates at each end of the Uche would be opened, and the people who were waiting would pour through to catch a glimpse of the Imam. And this is what I mean by Esh, the Esh of the revolution as it relates to the person of the Imam. That which came forth from the people looking up at the Imam, standing on his roof, calmly waving and acknowledging him, was nothing other than love. It was not the blind obedience given to an authoritarian political leader or some cheap politician who manipulates public opinion and gets himself elected president. It was the love of a people for one who embodied their deepest, most profound spiritual and religious and cultural ideas. This is the important thing, one of the many important things to remember about the Imam. That same month that I was in Tehran, December 79, was of course marked by the so-called hostage crisis. And I recall that in front of the U.S. Embassy, every day there were masses of people going back and forth, demonstrating, and at the same time celebrating that which was called, by the Imam, the Second Revolution. The First Revolution, of course, is getting rid of the Shah. The Second Revolution was the occupation of the U.S. Embassy. I have never seen a degree of popular enthusiasm on any occasion, nor do I expect to see it again, comparable to what I saw in Tehran in 1979. It was the month in which, for example, the Constitution of the Islamic Republic was brought before a referendum and received overwhelming approval. It was a month also in which, from the U.S. Embassy, a whole series of documents began to emerge. And it is based on those documents very largely that the U.S. Embassy, in effect, became renamed as Zania Josefsi, the Nestle Spies. To such a degree, I recall I was staying with a friend in North Tehran, and I would take a